Thank you for joining us today for the next webcast in our series, Hunton Global Privacy Update. I'm Bridget Tracy, a partner in the firm's London office, and I lead our privacy and cybersecurity practice in the UK. These webcasts are held every 2 months and are designed to provide informative updates on the latest issues in global privacy and data protection. We limit the webcasts to 30 minutes, and after the program, we post an on-demand recording on our privacy blog, www.huntonprivacyblog.com. As many of you know, our global privacy and cybersecurity practice has lawyers and privacy professionals located in the US, Europe, and Asia, and we assist clients all over the world. We're recognized as privacy leaders globally. For more information about our practice, visit our blog, mentioned earlier, huntonprivacyblog.com, and our EU Data Protection Regulation Tracker, www.huntonregulationtracker.com. Today we'll focus the update on the proposed EU General Data Protection Regulation and the compromise text recently adopted by the European Parliament. This is a significant step in the development of the regulation, and it's important to understand what these far-reaching proposals could mean if they're adopted. In our commentary, we've picked out a number of key proposals that would have a significant impact if they were adopted. These proposals are not the obvious headline grabbers, but they're requirements that will impact most of us and will require thoughtful consideration and resource to implement. We'll begin our conversation by taking stock of the legislative process itself. I'm joined by my colleague, partner Wim with Now Alerts, who leads our privacy practice in Hunton & Williams Brussels office. I'm going to hand over to Wim, who will talk us through the current status of the legislative process. Wim.
Thanks, Bridget. Before we get into the details of the Parliament's compromise text, it might be useful to provide a brief update on the draft regulation. Remember that the European Commission released its draft regulation almost 2 years ago, in January 2012, and it was then sent to the European Parliament and the Council for their review. Last month, on October 21st, the European Parliament's Committee on Civil Rights, Justice and Home Affairs, better known as the LIBE Committee, finally finished its review of the draft and agreed on a compromise text after having discussed more than 3,000 amendments proposed by the different committees in the Parliament. With that, the Parliament pushed the ball back into the court of the European Council, because as soon as the Council agrees on a common position internally, based on its reading of the proposed regulation, the European Parliament, the Council, and the Commission can start joint negotiations with a view to reaching a consensus on a final text. This will be the so-called trilogue negotiations. Now, the Council met in Brussels on October 24th and 25th to debate the EU's digital agenda. And in the wake of that meeting, both Jan-Philipp Albrecht, who's the rapporteur for the proposed regulation in the Parliament, as well as Viviane Reding, Vice President of the European Commission, both urged the EU leaders to commit to adopting the proposed regulation by spring 2014. In any event, before the European elections in May 2014, and for that purpose, they were hoping for a clear signal from the Council by means of a mandate to start the trilogue negotiations as soon as possible. However, unfortunately, this didn't really happen. There were initially mixed messages from the different member state leaders. For example, there were statements from the French president and the Belgian prime minister indicating that it may not be technically feasible to be ready for adopting the regulation in 2014, because there is still a lot of work that needs to be done. The UK government has also made it clear that it would rather spend more time negotiating the contents rather than rushing it through and compromising on quality. Nonetheless, the Council's official statement at the end of that summit in Brussels merely said that, and I quote, "The timely adoption of a strong EU General Data Protection Framework and the Cybersecurity Directive is essential for the completion of the digital single market by 2015. Now, timely adoption can mean many things. The adoption of the proposed regulation at the end of 2014 or early 2015 would still be timely from the viewpoint of the digital agenda. key question is, how quickly can the Council finish its reading of the proposed regulation, and when will it be ready to start the trilogue negotiations? And this is really hard to say. The Council convenes again in the first week of December, and possibly we'll know more at that point. We're also likely to see a period of intense negotiations in the coming month. But if the trilogue is delayed because members of Parliament are shifting their attention to the 2014 elections, then progress of the draft regulation could be derailed.
Thanks very much, Wim. Against that background, let's turn now to some key themes that arise from the Parliament's compromise text. We'll start with the general principles and turn to Article 6, which sets out the bases for lawful processing of personal data. Now, just by way of reminder, data processing in Europe is only lawful if one of the bases for lawful processing set out in the legislation can be met. This will remain the position under the proposed regulation. Two of the grounds that are most commonly relied on currently are legitimate interests and consent, and both of these grounds remain in the proposed regulation. However, the Commission's original text proposed to tighten both grounds and caused really some consternation as to how business-as-usual processing would continue. Let's look at how the European Parliament addresses each of these issues. First, legitimate interests. Now, this is an important basis for data processing, but it's used fairly unevenly across Europe. In the UK, many businesses currently rely on this ground for really quite a wide range of processing activity, and the Information Commissioner encourages its use. In contrast, in some European countries, such as Italy, regulatory approval is required before legitimate interests can be used. The formulation proposed in the Parliament's compromise text really encourages the use of this ground. Let's look at the text of Article 6F. It's very close to the text of the current directive. It permits processing that is necessary for the purposes of the legitimate interests of the controller, except where such interests are overridden by the interests or fundamental rights and freedoms of the data subject. There are two additions, however. The text acknowledges the legitimate interests of a third party to whom the data are disclosed, and it also requires that the processing undertaken by the controller or third party must meet the reasonable expectations of the data subject based on his or her relationship with the controller. Now, these changes, and in particular the reference to the data subject's reasonable expectations, broaden the scope of the legitimate interest basis and offer a degree of flexibility while maintaining safeguards in some situations. So, for example, where the data subject is a child, then careful assessment will be needed to ensure that the processing is consistent with the reasonable expectations of a child. On the other hand, and this is specifically called out in Recital 38, the processing of pseudonymous data should be presumed to meet the reasonable expectations of a data subject, as would the processing of data for the purpose of ensuring network and information security. In a new recital, 39B, there's a presumption that processing data for the purpose of direct marketing for the controller's own or similar products or services is carried out for the purposes of the controller's legitimate interests, provided the individual has the means to object to the processing. Now, this approach to legitimate interests is in stark contrast to the Parliament's original proposal, which sought to limit the availability of legitimate interest and set out a list of situations in which the controller's or the data subject's legitimate interests respectively would prevail. The Parliament's compromise proposal offers more flexibility to a controller than the original proposal and really should be seen as a very positive step for businesses that already rely extensively on legitimate interests. I think this development is also interesting given the fact that the working party is currently preparing an opinion on legitimate interests, and it may well be that what we see in the Parliament's approach reflects some of the thinking proposed by the working party. Let's turn now to one of the other widely used bases for data processing, that is consent. The treatment of consent is interesting. Just as legitimate interest appears to have been made more widely available, in contrast, the availability of consent is being tightened. Now, this is an important issue to be aware of because many, many companies rely heavily on consent. The Commission's original proposal signals a move away from implied consent to a regime that requires consent to be explicit in every case in which it is relied on, so not just in the case of processing sensitive personal data. Neither the Parliament's compromise text nor the Council's proposal have challenged the requirement for explicit consent. So this requirement looks set to stay, and that of itself would be a fairly fundamental change. The compromise text goes further, however. Article 7, Conditions for Consent, provides that consent shall be purpose-limited and shall lose its validity when the purpose ceases to exist or as soon as the processing of personal data is no longer necessary for carrying out the purpose for which it was originally collected. This means that controllers will need to think really very carefully about how they structure requests for consent, or indeed whether consent is the most appropriate ground to rely on. The concept of consent having an expiry really is a fundamental change. The compromise text also deals explicitly with the need for consent to be informed and freely given. Recital 33 specifically refers to the use of default options or pre-filled forms or checkboxes that the individual is required to modify, and it states that these do not express free consent. This is an important change for website operators who routinely rely on pre-selected checkboxes. More generally, companies that rely on consent will need to undertake a careful review of their consent mechanisms. Let's move now to a new proposal from the Parliament. New Article 13A envisages the creation of standardised privacy notices that provide really quite extensive information to individuals, but using symbols. For example, one of the requirements is to tell individuals whether personal data are collected beyond the minimum necessary for each specific purpose of the processing. Now, the symbol for this is a circle with three stylized people in the middle and a magnifying glass hovering over the person in the center. The second requirement is to state whether personal data are retained beyond the minimum necessary for each specific purpose of the processing. The symbol for this is a circle containing a floppy disk and a downward-facing arrow. The concept here appears to be to provide an at-a-glance guide to key aspects of data protection using a table that will contain the symbols, some brief text, and then a tick or a cross to indicate whether the requirement has been met. In addition to that, Article 14, which specifically addresses privacy notices, has been amended so that the text-based privacy notice will function as a second layer of information following on from the symbols. The privacy notice itself, the text-based notice, would need to explain a number of specific requirements. For example, if legitimate interests is relied on as a basis for the processing, then the privacy notice would need to explain the balance of interests. The notice would also need to specify the basis for international data transfers and the appropriate safeguards that are relied on. In connection with profiling, the notice would need to provide information about the existence of profiling, the measures based on profiling, and the likely effect on individuals. And this is a point, actually, that Wim will pick up shortly, Article 14 requires the notice to state whether personal data were provided to public authorities during the last consecutive 12-month period. The Parliament's approach to information policies, or privacy policies, really contrasts with the Council's compromise text released during the Irish Presidency. Now, that text proposed really reducing the lengthy list of notice requirements to two key points. first, the identity of the controller, and secondly, the purposes of the processing of the personal data. Clearly, the two institutions have taken an entirely different approach on this issue, and it remains to be seen just where their negotiations on this eventually come out. But if the Parliament's text is adopted, organisations will need to do quite a bit to recast their privacy notices, and they'll certainly need to review them more frequently than most currently do. Let's move now to look at sanctions. The compromise text includes changes to the administrative sanctions that can be imposed for breaches of the regulation. It increases the maximum fine from the 2% originally proposed by the Commission to a fine of up to 5% of annual worldwide turnover, or 100 million euros, whichever is the greater. The text also provides for alternative sanctions, including written warnings and data protection audits. There's also guidance on the factors that would be used to select the most appropriate sanction in a given case, including the nature, gravity, and duration of any noncompliance, whether the infringement was negligent or intentional in character, the repetitive nature of any infringement, how much supervisory cooperation there's been, the level of damage suffered by individuals, and actions taken to mitigate any damage. These factors are broadly similar to the harms-based considerations that many DPAs currently take into account. Let's move now to look at another new concept, and that is this concept of the European Data Protection Seal. This is set out in Article 39 and is something new proposed by the Parliament. Essentially, this is a certification program that would enable controllers and processors to have their data processing activities audited and certified by a supervisory authority or their accredited third party. The scope of the audit would be an assessment of processing and compliance with the regulation generally, but with specific focus on Article 5, which are the general principles of data processing, Article 23, data protection by design and by default, and Article 30, which is the security provision. There would be a publicly available register of seal holders, so the fact that you'd been certified would be publicly available, and the seal would be valid for 5 years, and after that it would need to be renewed. There would be a fee charged for the certification process, and this would offer a way for data protection authorities like the ICO in the UK to replace the funding that they'll lose when registrations are abolished. What's the incentive for an organisation to submit to audit? Well, there seem to be two incentives. First, in the event of a violation by a certified business, a fine would only be imposed in the event of negligence or intentional breach. Second, seals would offer a new cross-border data transfer mechanism. Certified organisations could rely on their privacy seal as an adequate basis for transfers of data outside the EEA, provided both the exporter and the importer held valid seals. Now, this clearly envisages a rival program to the current US Safe Harbor, although with the advantage of enabling transfers to other countries as well as to the US. I think a further point that requires some further consideration is the relationship between a seal and BCRs. This is not explicitly referenced in the text, but I think this is an issue that we'll need to consider further. Now, let's move to look at a number of other changes. We've grouped these together under the theme of internal controls, and I'm going to hand over to Wim to talk us through these proposals. Wim.
Thank you, Bridget. As far as internal controls for compliance are concerned, the compromise text introduces a number of important changes to the initial proposal from the Commission. First of all, as I'm sure everyone knows, the Commission draft of January 2012 replaced a very cumbersome system of notifications to supervisory authorities with a system of internal record keeping by data controllers, processors, and controllers' representatives in the EU. Now, the Parliament's compromise text take the same approach, but the list of documentation to be kept internally is far shorter, and it's limited to only name and contact details of the controller or joint controllers of the data protection officer, if there is any, or of controllers to whom personal data are disclosed. On the other hand, the compromise text extends the provisions on accountability and responsibility of controllers in Article 22, and the text now actually includes the term accountability as well. Controllers will need to take all reasonable steps to implement compliance policies and procedures that persistently respect the autonomous choices of data subjects. And these compliance policies should be reviewed at least every 2 years, and they need to be updated where necessary. There is now also a requirement for data controllers to include in their regular general reports, such as annual reports of publicly traded companies, a summary of their data protection compliance policies and measures. And this is a return to an idea that was discussed many years ago to raise the profile of data privacy in business by incorporating it into annual reporting obligations. It will certainly make privacy certainly a management issue if it isn't already the case, given all the other requirements and penalties that are in the proposed text. By the way, a similar system is already in use in Finland, where companies publish data balance sheets, albeit on a voluntary basis. Under the compromise text, there are still a number of situations in which controllers and processors may need to liaise with supervisory authorities. For example, the compromise text imposes an obligation to carry out data protection impact assessments if a processing operation presents specific risks. For example, if businesses are processing personal data relating to more than 5,000 data subjects during a consecutive 12-month period of processing, or if special categories of personal data are processed, location data, or data on children, or also data on employees in large-scale filing systems. In all those cases, the controller and the processor must take or must make that assessment available to the supervisory authorities if they request it. And there is now also a requirement to conduct a compliance review at the latest 2 years after the carrying out of the impact assessment. And this compliance review should demonstrate that the processing of personal data is performed in compliance with the data protection impact assessment. Another change involving supervisory authorities that I wanted to mention relates to breach notification requirements. The compromise text relaxes the requirements to notify data breaches to the supervisory authorities. The 24-hour window to report a breach to the supervisory authorities is deleted. Now, breaches must be reported without undue delay, which, according to the recitals of the compromise text, should be presumed to be no later than 72 hours. There is still no notification threshold, which could potentially raise issues of over-reporting if the compromise text is adopted as is. And in fact, data protection authorities could be overwhelmed under the current regime as it is proposed by the compromise text. And last but not least, the compromise text also introduces specific rules for transferring or disclosing personal data to authorities in third countries. Where a judgment of a court or a decision of an administrative authority of a third country outside of EEA requests a controller or a processor to disclose personal data, then the controller processor would have to notify the supervisory authority of the request without undue delay and obtain prior authorization from the supervisory authority for the transfer or the disclosure. In addition, the controller or processor would also have to inform the data subjects of the request and of the authorization of the supervisory authority. And if personal data was provided to public authorities during the last consecutive 12-month period, then data subjects would also have to be informed of that. These new provisions appear to address fears surrounding foreign law enforcement access to data following the recent PRISM revelations and were a recent addition in the compromise text. Moving to a next topic of main establishment and determining decision-making entities for controllers and processors. The compromise text clarifies the concept of main establishment as the place of establishment of the undertaking or group of undertakings in the EU, where the controller or processor, where the main decisions as to the purposes, conditions, and means of the processing of personal data are taken. Now, in order to determine the main establishment, a number of criteria may be considered, including location of the controller or processor's headquarters, or the location where effective and real management activities are exercised. The concept is crucial for determining the lead supervisory authority in the EU. If a controller or processor is established in several countries in the EU, or where personal data of residents of several member states are being processed, then the lead authority would be the authority for the country in which the controller or the processor has its main establishment. So it's a very important concept. The idea is that one supervisory authority in the EU should act as the single contact point and the lead authority responsible for supervising the controller or the processor throughout the European Union, taking all related decisions in order to increase consistent application, provide legal certainty, and reduce administrative burden. Now, it's not immediately clear, if it's not immediately clear who the lead authority is, then it would be up to the European Data Protection Board, which will be the successor of the Article 29 Working Party, to make a decision here. There are still many questions on how the system will work in practice. Some have floated the idea that the criteria for main establishment should be the same as those specified in the Working Party's opinions on binding corporate rules and how to establish a lead data protection authority for the purposes of binding corporate rules approval. But we'll need to see or wait to see if this will actually be used as guidance going forward. And a final topic that we wanted to bring to your attention relates to a new category of personal data that has been introduced by the compromise text, and that is the category of pseudonymous data. Pseudonymous data are defined in the compromise text as personal data that cannot be attributed to a specific data subject without the use of additional information, as long as such additional information is kept separately and subject to technical and organizational measures to ensure non-attribution. Now, the idea behind introducing this new definition is that the processing of pseudonymous data is considered less risky, and therefore more lenient rules should apply. What this means in practice is that where a controller is unable to comply with the draft regulation because it's processing pseudonymous data and does not know the identity of the data subject, then the controller would not be obliged to comply with that particular provision of the regulation. Also, when a controller wants to rely on legitimate interest as a legal basis for processing that is limited to pseudonymous data, then the processing would be presumed to meet the reasonable expectations of the data subject, and the controller would not need to prove that those expectations are met in order to rely on the legitimate interest legal basis. Also, profiling based solely on the processing of pseudonymous data would be presumed not to be significantly affecting the interests, rights, and freedoms of data subjects, and therefore would be permitted. I think that the introduction of this new category of data is likely to be a game changer in certain industries like telecoms and medical research, where businesses often rely on encoded and key-coded data. In the current regime, there is only personal data, anonymous data, and then there's a gray zone in between, which many companies are carefully navigating based on the guidance provided by the Article 29 Working Party. Again, this is likely to change. And with this, I turn it back to you, Bridget.
Thanks very much, Wim. When we started this discussion today, I mentioned that the topics we'd cover were not the headline grabbers, but instead some of the many other issues that are likely to affect most businesses, and which will require careful consideration ahead of implementation. I hope that our discussion has provided you with some practical insights into the issues that your organization will need to focus on. Just before we close, however, I wanted to mention briefly the right to be forgotten. This concept spawned a great deal of heated debate and generated many column inches of commentary. However, there was real concern that the right promised more than it delivered, if I can paraphrase the UK ICO. And it's interesting to see that now it has been downgraded to a right to erasure. More broadly, however, the Parliament's recharacterisation of the right to be forgotten and the toning down of a number of other proposals, as well as a move towards the centre ground, reflects the Parliament's determination to push this legislative proposal forward. Whether they're successful remains to be seen, but as Wim noted, we ought to know more in early December. Do watch the Hunt and Privacy blog for further developments. Thank you for joining us for this Global Privacy Update call. The next call is scheduled for the same time on the 21st of January. We'll send out an invitation closer to the time, but you may wish to mark your calendar now. Many thanks and goodbye.